Welcome to the Sutlifting Report, the place where the news is never hidden and the truth always wins. Today, I'm sharing a recent interview by Sophie's Corners, Karina Schmidt, did of me on my book, The Cancer of Civilization Jihad. But this is a Christian news show, and we start with a reading from the Bible. Today, we're reading Exodus 4, 1 to 9. And Moses answered and said, "But behold, they will not believe me, nor hearken unto my voice, for they will say, the Lord has not appeared unto you. And the Lord said unto him, what is that in your hand? And he said, a rod. And he said, cast it on the ground. And Moses cast it on the ground, and it became a serpent. And Moses fled from before it. And the Lord said unto Moses, put forth your hand, and take it by the tail. And he put forth his hand, and caught it, and it became a rod in his hand. That they may believe that the Lord God, their father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has appeared unto you. And the Lord said furthermore unto him, put now your hand into your bosom. And he put his hand into his bosom, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous as snow. And he said, put your hand in your bosom again. And he put his hand in his bosom again, plucked out his hand out of his bosom, and behold, it was turned again to his flesh. And it shall come to pass, if they will not believe you, neither listen to the voice of the first sign, that they will believe the voice of the latter sign. And it shall come to pass, if they will not believe also these two signs, neither hearken unto your voice, that you shall take of the water of the river and pour it upon the dry land, and the water which you take out of the river shall become blood upon the dry land." So, you know, Moses had heard God's call. His response starts with, but they will not believe me. You almost feel like screaming, no, wrong answer. We serve a personal God, one who does not seem to mind our talking with him, even when we disagree. It's okay that we're wrong. Sometimes we just need more from God to stand taller. This is still a conversation. It takes two to have a conversation. Think of how well-prepared Moses was because of this being a conversation. When you serve a God who is able to know your answer before you even respond, you get a well-prepared answer. But what if they do not believe me? Who is they here? The Hebrews in captivity, or is he talking about the Egyptians or both? Moses is speaking primarily of his own people who barely know him. As much as it sounds bad to have said this, you have to ask yourself, would you believe a stranger or someone you know more? God gave him signs to prove who sent him. These signs were sent to convince the Hebrew people that the great I Am indeed had sent Moses. God was demonstrative. He had Moses see each one of these signs. This must have given him such a level of confidence. God did not give him one sign. No, he gave Moses five signs. A rod to snake, a snake to rod, the normal to leprous, the leprous to normal, water to blood, five signs. It's almost as if God is saying, yes, my people are stubborn and do not listen to just anyone. Would you have listened to someone you barely knew after he turned and claimed to be sent by God? I think I might have needed some convincing. I don't know about you. Would this make his message more powerful when it was delivered? Indeed. God's answer here makes the message he is asking Moses to deliver one of great power. Dear Lord Jesus, you love even me. How that is possible despite all I have done baffles me. You even make special plans just for me, just for you guys. He does. Lord, you prepare the way in which I will go. Lord, embolden us that we may share your word with others. In Jesus' name, amen. Now, without further ado, I'm just going to start playing this interview. It is powerful. It is incredibly powerful. I say that because I think the interviewer did an outstanding job. So I'm just going to get that started. I did not prep up where things are, unfortunately. So I'm just going to find that interview and pull it up on BTR first, as usual, and then I will play it on the video. I have to say again, it's nice. I've had a lot of interviews, but this was one of the better ones I've I've had. That was impressive. And let me just find that. The joy of having too many audio files. We're getting there. Okay, here we go.
Second. Yes, now.
Good afternoon. My name is Karina Schmidt, and I'm here today with my guest. First, I want to clarify a technical issue that we had yesterday on Blog Talk Radio, where unfortunately I was unable to hear my guest today.
Getting there.
So this is the reason why we're doing the interview as a video interview, and perhaps you'll get more out of it this way. It is an honor to have Paul Sutliff with us today. He is my guest.
Yeah.
He is the author of several books, which we're going to go over in just a moment. He's also an Islam researcher, and that is exactly what we're going to be talking about today. Today's topic is civilization jihad and how Islam is spreading quite rapidly throughout the Western countries. Paul Sutliff is the author, most recently, of The Cancer of Civilization Jihad and Civilization Jihad and the Myth of Moderate Islam. He has also written a book which addresses directly social studies teachers in high schools predominantly, but also middle schoolers could benefit from this book. And that is another one that we're going to talk about a little bit later. Now, Paul Sutliff will discuss his extensive research today into jihadism that's waged on Americans right before your very eyes. He is also going to discuss questions such as what is hijra and its purpose. And let me introduce Paul Sutliff. Thank you very much for being with us again today. We had to cancel yesterday, but it's a pleasure to have you again.
It's a good honor to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Paul, tell me and my audience, what is hijra and its purpose? Can you define that for us and give us an idea so that we better understand what this really means?
So hijra is actually the word migration in Arabic. So if you think about, you're talking about someone to migrate, that they're you're telling them to go on a hijra. But the word hijra has some very specific meaning to Muslims. The hijra is, in Islam, hijra is where Islam actually starts. The year zero of Islam begins with the concept, the hijra, again, a migration from Mecca to Medina, which was Yathrib back then. So the concept of hijra is extremely important to Muslims. Now, in Islam, there is a direction to migrate generally to Muslim lands. You're not supposed to migrate to non-Muslim lands. And there's actual, you know, I'm going to read a brief quote. I actually did a lot of research on this because I thought, you know, that's what I'd heard. So I went and I looked at this site called Islam Question and Answers, and they, you know, they started out with a condemning those Muslims who live amongst non-Muslims. And it said, in the Sunnah, the Prophet said, I disown every Muslim who settles among the Mushrikin, the non-Muslim. And this comes from the Hadith narrated by Abu Dawood. It's classified as Sahih. So that means it is, you know, considered reliable. It is trustworthy, this Sahih, this Hadith. So
my apologies.
It's the joy of children and dogs at home.
Yeah, they're beautiful and a handful.
So the hadiths and the hadiths are just part of this. The Quran has several verses that talks about why you should have a hijra, not necessarily to a Muslim country. And this is where it gets interesting. I'm going to quote from Surah 2:218 first. It says, surely those who believed and those who emigrated and performed jihad. Now, okay, so when I read that, like, wait a minute. so So the purpose of emigration is before you perform jihad. Jihad is holy war. So, okay, let's think
jihad
about
that. Jihad also means struggle, isn't that correct?
No, that is misinformation. It is total misinformation. In fact, I'm going to be attending via online a Zoom session that is advertised as the Palestinian struggle. So for every Muslim out there, oh, they're having a Palestinian jihad moment. But for us English speakers, they have done this so we would be stupidly, you know, take it the wrong way. A lot of Islam does things, it's called doublespeak. They will say one thing and mean another. And that is another topic we'll talk about, lying. There's actually five words that have to do with lying in Islam. I only discuss one because information overload is too much for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get back to the topic of this. Now, I just quoted Surah 218. And this is, again, it's repeated in the the Quran. Surah 872 says, surely those who believed and those who emigrated and performed jihad with their money and their lives. So now we're talking about, okay, so money has to go to jihad. That makes some sense. Holy war, okay. But let's talk about what jihad means. In the United States, there is a group of Muslims, the Muslim Brotherhood, who have been coordinating here since the 1960s. They came over through Canada, and then they got into the colleges, and they now influence your current textbooks and stuff like that. But they came here for the purposes of making this an Islamic country and to turning it into a Sharia country. That's what the Muslim Brotherhood's goal is. So, again, their concept, they even define this in the explanatory memorandum of the Muslim Brotherhood. It explains exactly what their goal is, and they created the term civilization jihad to explain.
So let me back up so that everybody understands, because you say something in your book, and this is a direct quote explained in the Sharia law. That goes like this, quote start. Jihad means to war against non-Muslims, and its etymological is derived from the word mujahada, signifying warfare to establish a religion. And that is exactly what you're talking about, that the two Arab Canadians did as they entered the United States. Is that correct?
Well, they weren't even Arab Canadians. What they did is they came from countries like Iraq and Iran, and they came through Canada because they weren't legally allowed to come to America. They did this because they could become Canadian citizens in a very short time. I think it was 2 to 3 years. And then they came here. So this is all – it was all a planned way. I've actually talked to former CSIS on this, and I didn't realize that that was the original way that they got in, learned that Fortunately, that was after I wrote that second book. So, but as you, the joy of being a research writer is you keep learning what you don't know, so you get to know more of what you don't know.
And add to it, yes.
So, yes, this battle is ongoing. So when I say civilization jihad, the goals here, I have to understand that jihad has three different levels. One is you have to have hatred in your heart towards all that is not Islam, and that includes, you know, basically non-Muslims. Then you have to, the second level is where they call it, you know, writing jihad, or they'll call it, writing jihad is probably the best way to put it, or speech jihad. And what they're doing is they're allowed to go out and give speeches, they're allowed to write, and their goal, again, is to change everything around them. If that means deceiving, all for the purposes of making something, this is a jihad. This is a holy war through speech, through writing, misinformation, to make the country Muslim. And then the last level is called the level of the hand or action.
And the
physical jihad, yes. So this is extremely important because President Joe Biden unknowingly actually called for jihad as he was running for president, which still blows my mind that he actually quoted
this. One can
stuff.
Actually ask them oneself if he did it unintentionally or intentionally, as things are progressing in the United States right now. So we're talking about the concept of, and forgive me if I'm mispronouncing the Arabic word, taqiyya. Pardon.
And I am not going to be the perfect person to pronounce any Arabic. I borrow from my friends who translate. I have a colleague, Usama Dac, who actually translated the Quran. If you're looking for a uncorrupted Quran, what I mean by uncorrupted, the Muslims have translated into English the Quran, and the vast majority of them are corrupted because they don't want the English people to know the truth. English, or I'm saying the non-Muslim people mm-hmm. to know the truth. So if you're looking for one, you can go to Straightway Ministry, and you can look for the Generous Quran. The funny thing is most Qurans will say on them the Holy Quran. My friend who's on my Dak, being an Arabic speaker, laughs at that because there is no such thing, that word holy in Quran, there's no place that it actually exists. The label on top of the Quran is the Generous Quran in Arabic. But, you know, us English people or us non-Muslims, we don't get to know that, which is humorous.
Well, that's interesting that we see a form of censorship using language barriers, which is something that has been employed in many cultures in order to keep information from people altogether.
Well, so this is actually a standard by Islam. I'll say Islam. I'm against the ideology. All right, this is where I stand. I have no hatred towards Muslims. I'm against the ideology, and I'm pretty clear with that. The way I wrote this book. It's important to understand that Islam is out there to deceive even Muslims. Now, what do I mean by that? Most Muslims do not read Arabic, so they can't know these things. They're not allowed to read the Quran in many ways. They'll tell you not to read the Quran unless you read it in Arabic. And that creates a number of problems because most Muslims do not know what they believe because they do not read the Quran.
Because they don't read the language.
Yes. So this is actually somewhere around 80%, it might be 88% of all Muslims are unable to read it in Arabic. So they are encouraged not to read it in their own language.
So they get it in the filtered format.
They get it from
the filtered format, English, German, Spanish, whatever it may be. And you discussed that in Civilization, Jihad, and... We have that available at Sophie's Corner in Miami International Mall, and it's also available on sophiepublishing.com and Amazon. I would encourage people to not look for it in Amazon, and I'd like to add this really quickly, because in Amazon they have increased the price to currently the last I saw was $902 for Paul Sutcliffe's book, when in fact it should be $18. So tell us, how exactly are they deceiving us besides through misinformation as a result of wrongful translation?
So here's another thing that they do, which is considering, and I talk about wrong translation. The number one thing today that I see that they misinform and are doing vastly to misinform the public is simply they've gotten into your children's textbooks. And I am a retired school teacher. I taught history for 20 years, and I watched the changes. In New York State, they have a mandate to teach that Islam spread through something called cultural diffusion. That is not correct. It spread through the sword. And that was what I was taught. When, if you're 50 years old, I'm 56. And if you are 50, in your 50s, you probably were taught that Islam spread through the sword. Your children are no longer taught that. In fact, they are taught that there are five pillars. This is problematic. because they leave out which Islam teaches is the sixth pillar, which is jihad. Mm-hmm. They only teach that, and then they tell you that this has to do with how they want to behave. Again, this
and can
is,
you quickly explain just very briefly what are the five and the most important one, the sixth pillar? The sixth pillar being jihad.
Five pillars. I have to stop and think. So the five pillars have to do with the first thing is a statement of faith. Then there's prayer, and then there's fasting, and then there's a something similar to tithing, and then you have to make a trip to Mecca. So we get to the
five.
It's a pilgrimage, and those are required. The pilgrimage is required once in your lifetime. These are impartial. They do not talk about the required behaviors under Islam. That would be to do that. We'd have to discuss Sharia. We'd have to look at the Quran. We'd have to look at Hadith. Muslims do not accept as their only holy book is the Quran, which is pretty much taught in public schools. It's incomplete without the Sunnah, which is the Hadith and the Sirah. The Sirah is the biography of Muhammad, the biographies of Muhammad. And this is extremely important because if a Muslim who is Muslim means submission, a person who is a submitter to mm-hmm. Islam. And Islam means submission. Please get that in your heads because you will be lied to by Muslims about what it says. We have a professor here in Rochester, New York, who goes around and tells people it means peace. And when he goes out, I show up and I say, so what does it mean in Arabic? And we've done this three times, and exactly three times, and he still does it knowing I'm there that I'm going to ask him. So what does it mean in Arabic?
Mm-hmm.
Submission. So you lied to him. Yeah.
Well, there are many, and that's not just in the United States. In Florida schools, they also teach that it means peace. And I know in European schools, they typically teach that Islam means a peaceful religion, when in fact it means submission.
And probably one of the most important things about the misinformation that they give out is a statement in Sharia that says it's obligatory to lie if the goal is obligatory. So that means if your goal is the spreading of Islam, your goal is to lie to the people.
This to the non-Muslims.
It's not just non-Muslims. This is what I originally, when I was writing this, that was my, I knew there was misinformation they were giving out to Muslims, but I didn't have anything to base it on. And I've been talking with others, and now I'm reading something called Islamization of Knowledge, which is a topic I have been looking at because of COVID-19. Now, COVID-19, there's a claim that Muslims were the worst hit. So the misinformation given to Muslims through medicine is one of the reasons why Muslims are suffering the most. So
what are they arguing specifically as the reason why Muslims are hit the worst?
So one of the reasons I believe is because of what they call Islamic medicine. Islamic medicine allows for, they've actually did huge videos and proclamations that camel urine is the cure to this. There was actually, you can find videos if you spend your time looking as camel urine is the cure to COVID-19. You will see that, and you'll see some people from Iran, some people from Iraq and Egypt advertising camel urine as the cure-all for COVID-19. And any doctor will tell you this is dangerous and bad for your health. But again, that's one of the reasons, and what I've been looking at in these topics of Islamization of knowledge in a specific area of medicine. They are publicly misinforming other Muslims about what Islam's contribution is to medicine. So again, understand that the law, the Sharia, which is the word for law in Arabic, it's obligatory if the goal is obligatory. So it's okay to lie to anyone, even other Muslims, as long as you're encouraging Islam.
As long as it's in the path of spreading Islam in non-Islamic countries.
Not only just in Islamic, non-Islamic countries. That's the thing to think about. It's wherever Islam is, wherever you are, you can lie to anyone as long as it furthers
Islam.
As long
as it's in the name of Islam.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's more deceptive than I originally had written about, which is it's quite a horrible statement. Because if you simply pick up the topic of Islamization of knowledge and you look at medicine, you will absolutely see this. And I've been going through, I've picked up about 6 scholarly articles. The topic, Islamization of knowledge, is considered a graduate level topic for Islam. And I've been on this topic because Dr. Shafiq out of Rochester, New York, mm-hmm. His professor was one of the guys who created this. And I've been following this topic, I'd say, for the last 8 years, but now I'm starting to dig a little bit deeper into it, specifically on medicine, and I still can't cease to be shocked when I'm reading, you know, I can get them deceiving us, but deceiving each other still shocks me.
Right. That brings me to a near conclusion that they must be practicing a form of racial or racist social norm about how they teach Islam, that there are 2 sets of rules,
yes,
depending on whether you're a believer or not a believer. Can you talk to us a little bit about the racist social norms that are practiced? Because if you're misinforming about things such as medicine and what cures COVID or any other illness for that matter to a certain group of people, based on whatever demographics you're addressing, you can argue that there's some social norms and some racist sentiments with that. Would you not say?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And when I started this section, I started thinking about my, as a teacher, I had had several people in my classes who were what they would call 5 percenters. And basically they say they believe 5% of what Islam has. And then they add everything else. And I had thought about that, you know, there. And then I had a large percentage. I worked in inner city schools. I had a large percentage of what they would call black Muslims. And again, they thought Islam was all about black people. But Muhammad was a white dude. he was white, and if you want to check me out, go find you'll find hadith, you'll find in the Sirah where Muhammad is continually described as this white dude, and it's sad.
So again, that's a step in the path of misinformation. And I know from research that I have done that Islam was sold and still is in many correctional facilities to African Americans,
yes,
as the religion of peace and so on. And so you can argue that they have targeted that specific demographic.
Exactly.
To wrap them up,
exactly,
and get the support it's based on a lie, which is okay as long as you're spreading Islam in their minds. But it's a racist thing, is it not?
It's incredibly racist. This is one of the things I was talking to my friend Usama Dakdak now. His native tongue is Arabic. And I wanted to know, you know, I was looking into racism, and one of the things that still shocks me about this, he talks about the 2 words for black in Arabic. Aswad means the color black.
Mm-hmm.
Abd is another word for black. It means slave. In general, when Muslims talk about black people or something black, they use the word abd, which means slave. So if they refer to a black Muslim, they might use the word abd. And so it makes you think, you know, if that's an acceptable, we would consider this racist language in any place in Western civilization. But this is this is shockingly normal.
It's socially acceptable to use the word "ab," and it makes you think also about the fact that in quite a few Muslim countries in Africa, slavery is very much practiced still, which is something that not all Americans know about.
What I would like to think about is you know, if you're in the United States and you're an educator and you use the N-word, you're going to lose your job. Today, in most jobs, you use that N-word, you've just committed suicide.
You're done.
Yes. So, but for a Muslim to use this term and refer to a black person, most black people won't know that they're being, they'll just say, I'm using the word for black. No, they're using the word for slave, which is also used for black interchangeably in their language. They could use the word aswad, but they choose mm-hmm. to use the word abd instead.
It's interesting from research that I have seen that most of the countries in Africa today that are practicing slavery, it's oftentimes Arabs that own the black Africans.
There's a case this week. I saw a news article this week about I think it was in Europe. It was a Saudi royal who was in trouble because he had, it could have been in France. The Saudi royal had been found guilty of owning slaves, and the case had just come back into the news this week. We've had this case in America in several places where Saudis have owned slaves and been caught. Now, the other persons who have been owning slaves that have been caught are other Muslims, because under Islam and under Sharia, you can't change those rules. You can't change those laws, and slavery is acceptable. If you want to see how evidence...
Well, let me clarify for our audience. You're telling me that Sharia cannot be changed? Similar to, for example, our legislative system, our constitution, you could amend the constitution, and we have amended the constitution in the United States. Other countries have done the same thing with their constitutions. You're telling me that Sharia cannot be changed, so they are going by a set of laws that's 1,400 years old? Am I correct?
Yes. And there is,
they're not
allowed to change it at all. In fact, to do so is considered apostasy. And under those rules and laws, you get killed with apostasy. If you are a Muslim, you leave Islam, you are supposed to be executed. And there's nothing pretty about that. That's happening all around the world, here, even here in the States and in Canada. That happens. I wish it didn't. But that's where another part in my book, I talk about freedom of speech. If you are you can't even have that as a Muslim. You can't speak against that. I have a friend who is a Christian that I see every week in church, and he's a former Muslim, and he's the one who helped me see some of the truths about what's actually happening. I actually could not have completed this section on hate without his wisdom, because I could not understand how, I'm talking about black Muslims in particular, how people, I come from a family where my mother and father and my sisters, we were raised in a loving home. I couldn't understand how the concept of hate could be so desirable to anybody. And, you know, he explained that point blank. So if you read this section in the chapter on does Islam basically, does it teach hate and express, you know, that's...
And you're right now referring to your new book, Cancer.
Yes. Yeah. This concept is so evil. It was hard for me to grasp.
So it's interesting that we have individuals in Congress, such as especially Ilhan Omar, that will demand freedom and freedom of speech and so on for Muslims. But what she's really demanding, you're saying, is only pro-Islam speech.
What she's demanding, actually, if you ever see her with a smile, I'd be shocked. I haven't seen that ever on any picture
Only
I've
a
seen
smirk.
Captured.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of Islam is having this hatred, and you have to understand it is because that is what they are taught and trained, and it's part of there is entire social norm, and this is where I talk. The reason I use social norms is because we're talking about behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's extremely important. So I put this book together from a social psychology point of view. If we look at social psychology and ask these questions, are the, you know, because we've been being told that's not Islam. They burned people that was one of the things they did that ISIS did. They burned people. And then people came out, Muslims came out and said, that's not Islam. Well, let's look at the history. Let's look at the Sunnah. Let's look at the Quran.
Let's look at the empirical data collected.
Yes.
But no one
did that. They just accepted what Muslims told them. And you can't do that. In fact, the only thing you could do that could be close to reliable, again, because Muslims do lie to other Muslims, is read what Muslims tell other Muslims. So that's why I have been spending a lot of time reading what Muslims tell other Muslims, and this topic of Islamization of knowledge is where I'm starting to find the problem where they're lying to each other, which I didn't.
And the part of lying to each other falls within the teachings of hatred, which is it's hatred in the heart through your verbal communication, as well as a physical attack on society, which is what we see through terrorism, correct?
In terrorism, this is an interesting term. In terrorism, let's go back a little bit farther. In the Quran, it says that Allah is basically the author of terrorism. It says Allah puts terror into the heart of the non-Muslim. So if you want to look for
you're telling me that a religion that some scholars claim is based on peace, it's a peaceful religion. And you have heard Barack Obama say that as well. That is incorrect, is what you're saying, and that in fact it is about instilling terror and fear in people. So the Quran does not, let me understand this, similar or comparing it to the Bible, it does not teach love. It actually teaches fear. Is that correct?
Fear and hate. I don't see love in there unless it's for your immediate family. But then fear and hate are, again, so if you're not Islamic enough, again, that's reason for fear, because you can't even be trusted you can't even trust your own family members. As time goes on, if your family member is not Islamic enough, they can kill you. That's allowed.
So let me understand. That makes sense in the sense that when you're teaching fear and hate, you are also more likely to get people to submit. And Islam is about submission. It's not about peace and love sharing, that kind of thing compared to the Christian faith, yes?
There is no real comparison. Noni Darwish, she actually looks at Islam. She grew up in Islam, and she actually believes that Islam was created as the opposition to Christianity. We've had a couple discussions on this. It kind of surprised me. I did not expect that answer. I've actually heard it someplace else a long time ago, but I have to say it was interesting hearing from a former Muslim that perspective. There is no, from what I read, there is no real love in Islam. There's no real love. There is so much hatred to all that is Islamic or not Islamic enough that they are willing to kill their own people if they are not Islamic enough. There's a case every single week that you can find just simply by, you can spend time Googling apostasy and news, or you can find honor killing and you look at mm-hmm. news. And these people who are being killed, these are family members. In Islam, the penalty for murder is it's a death penalty. However, the exception to the rule is like you've got a child or a mentally ill person. That's your first, first exceptions. The one that follows that is a Muslim for killing a non-Muslim. And then it talks about of killing your own family members, that that's permitted for the parents so they can kill their children.
That's honor killing.
And it's too disgusting and grotesque for the average human to grasp. Every time I read that,
it's unfathomable, really, that you can justify killing your own blood because of some sense of honor.
Say it's not honor. It's a sense of hatred. That's where I think we have called it honor killing. I think it's there's no honor in this. It is all about hatred.
I'd like to ask you to explain some, and it's connected with the killings as well and the mistreatment and the hatred and so on. Explain to us, please, how they treat women as you told me off the screen, sex objects, the abuse and the inequality that women are subjected to as members of society, contrasting that with our Western society. Can you explain to us how that...
I've interviewed Dr. Chesler, and I credit her for a lot of my knowledge in this area. Dr. Chesler, Phyllis Chesler, if you ever get a chance, I do recommend her book called Islamic Gender Apartheid. She experienced Islam up front and personal. She married a Muslim, and he was pleasant to her. While they were here in the States, they went back to his homeland, and all of a sudden she had to conform to what Islam requires. Muhammad says that hell is filled with women. That's just one thing. I'm going to read a quote from her book.
That's a strong statement.
Yes. And he won't even, I mean, there's things Muhammad does and he says and does that make women treated as lesser humans. I want to read a quote just from Dr. Chesler first, and then I'll tell you something else. She says, the plight of both men and women in the Islamic world and increasingly Europe requires a sober analysis of reality and a heroic response. World events have made feminism more important, yet at the same time, feminism has lost much of its power. To my horror, most Western academic and mainstream feminists have not focused on what I call gender apartheid in the Islamic world or in its steady penetration of Europe. So wherever they go, the value of women goes down. And this is where this is the quote I'm talking about. This comes from a hadith. It says, the prophet said, I was shown the hellfire and that the majority of its dwellers were women who were ungrateful. So it was asked, do they disbelieve in Allah? He replies, they are ungrateful to their husbands and are ungrateful to the favors and the good charitable deeds done to them. That comes from Sahih Bukhari. Now, Bukhari is considered a reliable hadith. So this is something they would hold up. There's a lot said on the distrust of women, even from birth. So a woman, they have a ritual they do, a sacrifice for a newborn called Akika. And they will actually do this when a child is born. And the value of the woman, even in this, the value of the sacrifice is less. It's really half that of what you would have for a boy. So it's even from birth they teach this. As a teacher, I had to go to a student's house, and I didn't have to. I felt it was my obligation. I went to a student's house to talk to his mother about his non-attendance. And I was not allowed to speak to her, or she was not allowed to talk to me. She had to talk through her son. So women, the minute they birth a male, they have birthed their guardian. And so even their children can tell them what to do when they are whichever age that they decide.
But only their male children.
Yes. Only their male children.
That's important to distinguish. So when Ilhan Omar, to bring her up again, talks about equality for women, it will never happen if it is to be in accordance with Islamic teachings, because women will always be beneath men, even their sons.
We can pick on Ilhan Omar real good for this one. She talks about equality, but the reason she wears that hijab is because of the inequality of women. She wears that hijab. The hijab is mandated so the Islamic men will not have sex with her. So she's wearing
the
hijab.
Also picked a white boyfriend, as far as I heard.
Yeah, and a non-Muslim one that I know of, unless he converted to Islam. Again, these are all things that can be done for the furtherance of Islam. Muslim women, by the way, are forbidden from marrying non-Muslim men. That's one of the reasons, other reasons you'll see murders. There's a recent case where I believe it was in Pakistan or India, a non-Muslim woman was dating a Muslim man, and the family beat her close to death and attacked the boy as well. And this is, sadly, again, this happens all too often, doesn't make the news all the time, but in Pakistan, this is considered normal behavior, unfortunately.
So they don't even branch out and say, okay, it's okay that a Muslim man marries a non-Muslim woman if he were to spread Islam. There's a double standard here, isn't there?
This is what the Hijra, going back to the Hijra, this brings us right back. One of the reasons why they'll come here, you'll see single men coming here, is they want to take wives who are non-Muslim. And mm-hmm. the minute that their child is born, that child, according to Islam, becomes Muslim. That child is automatically Muslim by birth, according to their belief structure. So they will actually, you've heard of stories back in the 80s. There were a lot of stories where a Muslim man would come here and he would marry a woman and he would kidnap the children and take them back to the Islamic country. That's because they believe that a child of Islam is automatically, a child of a Muslim man is automatically Muslim. And Sharia does not give them
the same. We've heard about that. Betty Mahmoudi actually talks about that in an old book anymore, Not Without My Daughter, which is based on her experience being married to an Iranian man and going to she was supposed to just visit him and his family in Tehran when she realizes that she has been completely lied to and that the daughter does not belong to her, because according to Islamic teachings, the child automatically belongs to the male.
And there is no acceptance. In fact, in a court of law, in a Sharia court of law, a woman's voice is only half that of a man. This is one of the reasons why they'll say they don't have rapes, because it's against, you have to have two women to equal one man. And then under the requirements for reporting a rape, you have to have either four women or one man and two women, or it'd have to be two men. So how many people commit rapes in front of others?
Nobody.
So the women can never, ever come forward unless they have witnesses. And this is why you won't find almost no sexual crimes reported in Islamic countries. So going back to
spreading to Europe too, I'd like to add that because in especially Scandinavian countries, I saw a report from Denmark and Sweden that rape in the last 10 years in those two countries have gone up to 1,400%. Supposedly Sweden being the worst one, and when they went back and looked at who the rapist was, they were largely Muslims, 94%, if I remember correct.
Yeah.
And hardly anything is done about it. In fact, I know from Danish law, if a victim of rape manages to fight back and severely injure the rapist, she's actually punished harsher than he would be if he were to be convicted of rape. Which is insane.
he can't be convicted of rape in their country.
Insane.
Yeah.
It's insane. It indicates to me that that Sharia has penetrated these countries' judiciary system and their legislative system.
In Sweden, I was going to say, if you want to, I recommend going to a site called samnytt.se, and it's Swedish news. It's a Swedish news that is not paid for by the
it's
government.
It's called Samnytt?
Samnytt.se. And you can go to Google Translate. Go to translate.google and start putting this in, and I have it automatically translated every time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a perfect translation, far from it, but...
No, it does a reasonable job.
Close. But I recommend this source because they do report these occurrences. And
there's another one that I can recommend, which is a Danish one, and Karen Jespersen, the journalist of, I can't remember what her husband's name is, they're running it together. It's called denkorteavis.dk, so it's denkorteavis, and I will put it on our website as
that
well.
That would be .de, correct?
I'm sorry?
That would be .de, correct?
.dk.
DK. Okay.
Yeah, it's called Denkorteavis, denkorteavis.dk, and she has done a tremendous job exposing the spread of Islam and the injustices with that in Denmark, but also Sweden for that matter. So I can recommend that website as well. We'll put it up on sophiepublishing.com in a blog after this interview here. I'd like we need to start rounding up here a little bit. What can Americans do today, and perhaps even Europeans also, to fight back the spread of Islam? What are some of the things that we must be aware about, and that we can actively do to push back?
Number one, become informed. That means you have to do some reading. You have to do, I say, your own research. You can read my books. I would say subscribe to things like Jihad Watch. You can go to my site, paulsutliff.blogspot.com, and read several things there. I try to keep people informed through Facebook and LinkedIn. You can follow me there. But staying informed is number one. Secondly, there is a push to put Islamic law into our courts. So if you are able to write, use your pen, and get a politician in your state government, I'm talking about your state government, to push a law, you want to create a new law, all you have to do is get a fire under someone's feet, find someone gutsy, and you want to push something called America's Laws for America's Courts. These are passing. There's actually, if you contact, it's AFLAC. You can probably find, if you look at an acronym up, there is a format. You could actually find the bill and submit your state's name in there and get it into your courts, get it made law in your state. It's extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
I would also say, when you see a mosque being built in your area, ask where the financing comes from. A huge amount of the financing, it comes from foreign governments. And if you also find something else, you'll find there's a organization in this country that is paid for by the Muslim Brotherhood. Again, the Muslim Brotherhood is a terrorist organization somehow allowed to operate in the United States. They are considered a terrorist organization by Saudi Arabia, by Egypt, by the United Arab Emirates.
Mm-hmm.
Actually is part of that. They're actually named by the same governments as a terrorist organization.
And CARE stands for the Council of American Islamic Relations.
And there is a, going through too many things. The joy of learning too much, sometimes you can't get it all out at the same time. There's an organization that finances most mosques in the United States. And if a mosque is not paid for by the local people, there you have to think about where does that money come from. That's what it comes down to.
And what's the purpose of placing it in that community?
Yeah, they will try and build these mega mosques. I have seen a few of these in Connecticut and a few other places that just the size is overwhelming. They'll never fill them. Is my point. It will never be done. Again,
so
they are required to
show up.
Does
it basically become a terrorist recruiting center?
They can be that. That again, in Islamic countries, mosques are places you can put your weapons.
Mm-hmm.
You will find that even in the States, they won't talk about this, but that is not. That has actually happened, that they've discovered that in some mosques here in the United States.
So they become more or less warehouses of weapons.
It is allowed in their belief structure. They are actually seeking money. Mosques are actually seeking money from the Department of Homeland Security and FEMA to harden their mosques against terrorist attack. And under Obama, they were getting thousands,
millions.
Tens of thousands of dollars. Yeah, up to the millions in for this purpose. It was supposed to prevent organizations from being terror attacked. I was able to prove through my research that FEMA was actually financing these hardening without lawfully meeting the requirements.
And let's remember that money is taxpayers' dollars is financing the protection of radicalizing of the United States, at the same time not providing the same security for Americans that are actually through taxes financing this with the endorsement of Obama, correct?
Yeah, I shy away from that term radicalization, though. I would say Muslims who choose to be devout.
Okay.
So the reason I shy away from radicalization is there's no proof of this term that I can find, because there's no – when you ask when I was over in France, I asked, what do they consider a radical or an extremist Muslim? When I was in the interior government of France, I asked this question, and their answer was a Muslim who commits violence. I've asked this in a couple of different countries from their governments that are in charge of, you know, what they call radicalization programs, and all these programs fail. There's a lot, again, because Sharia cannot change, the Quran cannot be changed, and because of those things, again, set in law, that they cannot be changed, then there's no acceptance of this, what Westerners might consider a reformed or a modified Islam. It cannot exist. So this is, again, the misinformation, and this is why reform does not happen.
Which
I would say
also brings us back to the failed attempt of assimilation.
Yes.
It fails everywhere.
That's an actually great topic, because because wherever Islam goes, they come in and they start a separate society. They do not comment.
I would like to read something to our audience from your book, The Cancer of Civilization, Jihad, because you bring up in this book, and I'm glad we are able to, and we still have time to touch on this, because this is quite important for people to understand, because you are talking about the creation of parallel societies, and we see that certainly in Europe, but also more and more here in the United States. And you give an example that starts in the United Kingdom. And let me just read this. In the United Kingdom, this self-imposed segregation and organization reveal a definitive goal and plan. Zsa Trifkovic, I am sorry if I mispronounce the name, wrote in 2002 of a 1982 declaration by the Islamic Foundation in Leicester that claimed the Islamic movement and quote start is an organized struggle to change the existing society into an Islamic society based on the Quran and the Sunnah and make Islam, which is a code for entire life, supreme and dominant, especially in the socio-political spheres. That the ultimate objective of the Islamic movement shall not be realized unless the struggle is made by locals. For it is only they who have the power to change the society into an Islamic society, end quote. And then you go on to say, this statement reveals that Muslims who appeared to come to the United Kingdom in the 1960s and 70s for a better life actually came with the intention of making the United Kingdom into an Islamic country. This is subversive, this is seditious, and this is hijra. Then you say Dr. Sukhdeo, is that correct?
Yes.
States that because of Islam's history of political dominance, during most of which Sharia was enforced, and because of its theology based on political power, Muslims have difficulty adapting to life as minorities in a non-Muslim environment. Traditionalists develop strategies to help Muslims maintain their Muslim identity and resist secular temptations. The organization of Muslims is seen as a religious obligation. That's a very important thing to pay attention to here. Dr. Sukhdeo noted that Islamic scholar Maduri, whom jihadists refer to often, talked about dawah and its inability to be effective if there is no organization. He said this about a Muslim's duty to organize, end quote, start. These aims cannot be realized so long as power and leadership in society are in the hands of the disbelieving rulers. So as long as the followers of Islam confine themselves to worship rites only when power is in the hands of the believers and the righteous, can the objectives of Islam be realized. Quite important to pay attention to as well. It is therefore the primary duty of all those who aspire to please Allah to launch an organized struggle that we could refer back to what Ilhan Omar is working on, sparing neither life nor property for its purpose. The importance of securing power for the righteous is so fundamental that neglecting this struggle, one has no means left to please Allah. And Dr. Sukhdeo also observed that Professor H. Ali Qahtani believed that the organization was the key to Muslim minorities groups' survival and says, the secret of Muslim communities which have been able to survive across centuries and generations lies in one word, organization. I'd like to bring attention to what we have talked about, but also how Barack Obama tried to organize the Muslim community to further that cause. And then you quote further, Islam cannot survive if individual Muslims believe it is a personal affair. When a group of Muslims is formed, the first thing they should do is keep Islam among themselves, is to organize themselves on an Islamic basis. To keep Islam alive from one generation to another, they should establish two basic Islamic institutions, the mosque and the school. And this brings us to what you were starting to talk about, the financing of schools, but or of mosques, but also of schools. We're seeing madrasas coming up in the United States. What is your response to this, just to elaborate on what you say in your book?
Traditionally in madrasas, in Islamic countries, a lot of sexual abuse happens. So whenever I see that, if they're boys or girls, or if it's if there's a co-ed school, the girls are taught separately. They cannot be taught together. There's a lot of dangerous problems here for children to begin with. Find out where this financing comes from. So find out how it's being paid for. You're not only protecting your local children from when these children will grow up, you're protecting those children that would go to these schools. So the biggest problem that people don't realize is the ones who suffer the most from Islam is the followers of Islam. So a lot of what we can say about this is if you can keep that madrasa closed, you're protecting those people who would go there. Sounds horrible. It really does, but that is the actual truth about it. You can find, there's actual sites that you can look up where for sexual abuse against Islam, against Muslims in, I would say, in the Western countries, and they're being reported and recorded. And when we heard about the Catholic Church sex scandals about 10 or 20 years ago, it's just, I would say, it's magnify that about 100 times. And that's what's happening about with Islam all around the world, and it's been happening, and it has not stopped.
Why is it that the media will not talk about it, you think?
Because it doesn't fit their narrative. They want to call Islam a religion of peace. I have friends who call it religion of pieces, but they are afraid to tell the truth. They fear.
Is it because they're afraid of retaliation by the Muslim community, you think?
I think that's part of it. I also think it's part of the red-green axis point of view where commies and Muslims work together to stand against all that is right in the world. If their message isn't being communicated, they can't work together. So I think that is the number one thing. They will fight to keep you stupid. Together, they'll do that to keep you oppressed, because if they can do that, they can be in charge. So they have to fight. So this is where you'll see, even in today's society under President Dementia, Biden, they will do this under him. You're seeing that a lot of this stuff is happening today. Communism is being pushed. There's so many other things that are going on now. As a united
communism
front,
and socialism is being pushed by Comrade Joe. Yes.
Yes. These are only happening because, again, if you become ignorant, you'll be able to see on my site. If you look for the Sutlifian Report in YouTube, you'll see I did a thing on this kind of thing happening now. It's a CRT. It's going a little bit straighter, farther out, but there is a joint effort with communists, socialists, and Islam. Keep in mind that philosophy, the enemy is my friend, that's how they can work together. Islam believes and teaches that if they can work with the commies to get across their point, they can kill the commies
the
off. Yeah, they can kill those. They can kill these commies and socialists off easily because they won't have enough guns. So they're expecting to do that at the end. The socialists and commies don't fit that.
That's sort of interesting that the far left is always talking about disarming Americans and gun control and taking away our right to protect ourselves. We hear the feminists say that, it's a woman's right to get a job and to protect herself, and they're always talking about women's right. I have to commend one person I heard recently for his views on this. He was on the Mike Essence show, Enrique Tarrio. He commented that it's interesting that the feminists are talking about women's right, but they will take away women's right to protect ourselves. And then we discover here in our discussion today that mosques are oftentimes being used as a warehouse for weapons. Your perspective.
I continually see some of these things. I recommend also the work of David Galbitz. You can find his work often displayed in, again, Jihad Watch and a few other places. But he actually goes into mosques and investigates them as an undercover person. And he has some other people that will go in and do that as well. It's not just the weapons that are there. It's what they're teaching. Again, that's the number one thing we're talking about is do they teach things like Sharia? Do they teach the oppression of women? Do they Are they okay with children being married off? Again, all these things are requirements and social norms under Islam. And that's the thing to keep thinking about. If you just look at Islam from a social psychology point of view, which is what this book does, is this really what you want in your community? When a mosque moves into your neighborhood, it is considered Islamic property. And under their belief structure, it can never, ever, anything that's bought by a Muslim, under their belief structure, can never be sold to a non-Muslim. So, again, these things are extremely important to grasp. If you live in a community where Islam exists, I'm talking about where
anywhere anymore in the United States and in Europe as well. So to round up here, we need to try to fight the parallel communities that are developing in the United States and identify those that are working in our system, in our school systems, in our legislative system, our school boards, those that are within law enforcement as well. We see an increase in Europe of law enforcement officers that are Muslims, which defies oftentimes the purpose of their job when it comes to, for example, rape victims. Your final thoughts on this, and again, your books are available without inflation.
You can only get them at Sophie's.
Yes, we do not inflate the prices. They are fair.
If I was to say, if the thing about social studies teachers is they're generalists. They can't know everything. So they're taught what they're told. I mean, they're given textbooks and told what they have to teach. So I'm not blaming any social studies teachers. I'm blaming the idiots who put the textbooks together. I'm blaming the publishing companies, not the teachers. I'm blaming the college professors who got involved in this corruption of the children's textbooks. And that's, again, from a person who taught social studies for 20 years, I can say that.
Mm-hmm.
Get involved in your community. Protect it by learning more. We can't become complacent and just accept what's happening around us. Not if you want to have a constitutional United States. You can't.
You can't have that when you have Islam in your society, because they'll never submit to, they'll never put the Constitution above anything that they do. Thank you so much for joining us today. This has been extremely insightful. Where, besides on SophiePublishing.com and Sophie's Corner in Miami International Mall, would you suggest that people go, for example, your website? What was your website again?
You can go to paulsutliff.blogspot.com, and you can go to paulsutliff.com if you're looking for a public speaker. That's where you can request me. You can also follow me on Facebook. I have a group called the Sutliffian Report. You can get pretty up-to-date information there. I'll do a live cast there once a week. And then I do a show on Blog Talk Radio also called the Sutliffian Report. Those are the best places to keep informed. You can connect with me on LinkedIn. I try to keep informed on a lot of different things. It's a fight. My suggestion is to just, it's work to keep informed. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. Some people like me can only do a couple topics.
Yeah.
And I
would certainly add to that, that one of the things that people can do when they get your book, or books rather, because there are several, is that get two or three of the same and then share it with your community. It makes a great gift for one, but it's not just the gift itself of giving something, but you're sharing information, which is extremely important in our society today in order to push back.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. It has been an absolute pleasure to have you on. And for those that were waiting for us to get the show started or the program started yesterday, our apologies. We did have some technical difficulties with Block Talk Radio for whatever reason. is unclear still. But we certainly will follow up with you, Paul. I recommend that people get the book, The Cancer of Civilization Jihad, and especially also the Civilization Jihad and the Myth of Moderate Islam. Both of them are extremely packed with in-depth research, and we thank you for your contribution to knowledge sharing.
God bless. Thank you all.
Thank you, and have a good night.
And for those of you listening on Black Talk Radio, that was an interview earlier this week, and I have to say, if you are in Florida and you're in the Miami area, please stop at Sophie's Corner and the Miami International Mall. There you can buy some of my books. So I'm hoping that that her work, the stand that she's taking of being daring to share the truth is going to benefit her financially. I have yet to really receive that kind of concept. I'm telling you this because I think it's important. Get out there and support those who are with you. Okay, now I'm back live on. Okay, and I've got. So here we go. I want to keep going on this topic. If you think Civilization Jihad is not real, it's happening here in the United States. Recently, a judge ordered a Muslim woman to go to a Sharia court. Did you hear that? Sharia court. For arbitration. That just blows my mind that there is such a thing as a Sharia court in the United States. So there's a lot of problems with that definition. And I have some real serious issues with that. But I want to share this article from The Blaze. Now, the article came out yesterday. So I just want to – this is by Phil Shiver. It's titled, Texas Judge Denies U.S. Citizen Due Process Rights. Sends her before Islamic Sharia Tribunal instead. The judge ordered a Muslim woman seeking a divorce from her husband to undergo arbitration through an Islamic court. And I just think about this. You're in the United States. There's a court system. Why would you – how could you ever be ordered to do that? That just escapes me. The whole concept of that happening just escapes me. So a judge in – Texas. I mean, that just, again, is another concept that escapes me, that this would happen in Texas. But a judge in Texas earlier this year effectively denied a U.S. citizen her constitutionally protected due process rights, choosing instead to order her to appear before an Islamic tribunal where her testimony is considered inferior. And when her lawyers sounded the alarm, the judge doubled down. In March, Collin County District Judge Andrea Thompson ordered a Muslim woman seeking a divorce from her husband to undergo arbitration, not through regular channels, but through an Islamic court, also known as a fiqh panel, a move that the woman's lawyers argue is an obvious, unconscionable affront to her constitutional rights. The woman, Maryam Ayad, was attempting to exercise her legal rights to a divorce last year with her husband, Ayad Hashim Latif, revealed that on the day of their wedding in 2008, she had signed an Islamic prenuptial agreement to have all matters regarding the marriage and divorce be decided according to Sharia law. Yeah, but this is America, okay? According to court documents, Miriam claims that she was essentially hoodwinked and defrauded into signing the document. At the time, she believed she was signing two copies of a marriage acknowledgement form, which is customary in Muslim cultures. Notwithstanding, Miriam's lawyers argue the agreement, which outlines the three main panels of a three-man panel of Muslim imams, are to decide all issues relating to the marriage, including alimony, division of property, child support, and even custody of the couple's six-year-old son, ought to be voided in lieu of U.S. law. A copy of the agreement was provided to The Blaze. The Texas district judge, in complete disregard of both federal and state law, ruled that this prenuptial agreement is binding without taking testimony from the wife. In absence of relief, Miriam will now be required to settle her divorce matters with the Islamic Association of North Texas in front of the Muslim clerics who view her testimony and evidence as carrying half the weight of a man's. Miriam's filing a writ of mandamus with the Fifth Court of Appeals in Dallas to restrict the lower court from enforcing the arbitration order. She is being represented by Michelle O'Neill and Michael Wazowski of the O'Neill Wazowski Law Firm in Dallas. I want you to think about that. Would you, I mean, if you're a female especially, how would you feel being ordered to go to a court where you could never be allowed to testify alone? Your word is never worth that of a man's. I would just think about that. How many women would be willing to go to a court where your word, your testimony is considered half that of a man's? I don't know one woman who would be willing to do that. I think of many foolish women who might say, well, let me give it a shot, but no. Some of these things you just have to hear to again, that happened in Texas, of all places. That really just blows my mind. I have another article here about jihad thriving in the United States. This came from Arkansas Online. I just got this article today, and it came out today. Helena West, a man pleads guilty in terror case. Now, they described this man as a native, right? In the next line, they say an Arkansas man from Yemen aided Al-Qaeda. Oh, okay. They're not telling the whole story. Just before we even start this, let me tell you. Al-Qaeda rules parts of Yemen. All right? I want you to consider that. Now, if they had started the article with saying, with a headline, with talking about a Yemeni American, would that have had a different concept? Maybe there's some wisdom in Trump's ban from citizens coming from America, not Americans, but from people coming from Yemen to this country. Think about this. So let me read the article. A Yemeni citizen, here we go. They didn't put that in the title, did they? A Yemeni citizen living in Arkansas pled guilty Tuesday, that's this Tuesday, in federal court to providing support and resources to the terrorist organization Al-Qaeda. Bilal Al-Rayani was living in Helena, West Helena, pleading guilty to one count of providing material support to a designated foreign terrorist organization. What is the correct term that should be used here? Al-Qaeda is an enemy of the United States. Could it be treason? Is this person aiding and abetting an enemy of the United States? Yes. Isn't that the definition of treason? Yes. So why do we need this charge called terrorism? You want to know what the real reason is? It gives a lesser charge. 20 years is about the maximum that they normally give. So think about that. Oh, they'll give you 20 years. What's the real charge? Again, treason. What's the penalty for that? Death. Oh, so they're afraid to charge people with treason. I think that's what it really is. So this man who went and aided Al-Qaeda, who pled guilty, you caught that, to one count of providing material support to a designated foreign terrorist organization. He pled guilty in all truthfulness to treason. He was helping an unknown, established, and documented enemy of the United States, an enemy that has killed thousands of Americans. And that's not called treason. What is? Someone explain that to me. This man is getting 15 years in prison and a fine of up to $250,000. And he openly admits he did this. He openly confessed to it in a court of law. These things shock me. And people will tell me what I'm saying is not true. Next up, I'm going to talk about a different topic. Let's talk about the insanity with COVID-19. There's a fight going on across this country. It has to do with the forceful push of vaccines that do not protect you from COVID-19. They even tell those getting the vaccine when you get there, when you go to get an injection, that it doesn't protect you against the virus. So I'm still at a loss of how they can call this a vaccine when they say that. So why are they mandating college kids in, Libland areas like New York State and Connecticut to get the vaccine? That's a great question. Well, there are many great patriots standing up against this. We've had patriots in Rochester, New York, stop it, do some protests on Saturdays. But this Saturday in Connecticut, patriots are going to be out at state universities, protesting the mandate for all, I want you to understand this, all state college students have to be vaccinated in order to go. I mean, that would make state colleges a great place for this grand experiment to be closely followed. Isn't that not what one of the goals of Pfizer? If you go to Pfizer or you go to Moderna or Johnson & Johnson and you look up their concept of the vaccine, you will also find they're doing great studies called experiments. What are these experiments about? They're about those people taking the vaccine. That could be you. They could be experimenting on you. They're talking about giving them fake vaccines. Oh, that's in there, believe it or not. That is in there. Consider that. So they're okay because this is still an experiment. It is not approved by the FDA. It is simply an experiment. Again, New York State has this same mandate. And I want to talk about the other thing here. People, I'm becoming of the belief, I played Dr. McCullough last week, and he said that this pandemic is all about the vaccine. I am becoming of that belief. New York State has that mandate making people having to be vaccinated to go to college. So you get special privileges, you're vaccinated. No special privileges for those who have had COVID-19 and are immune. In fact, their immunity is stronger. So if this is about being immune, why don't those who had COVID-19 get a special privilege? Think about that. So this isn't about immunity. It has nothing to do with immunity. It has to do with people getting the vaccine. So don't forget this last part, that they're talking about injecting a biochem tech vial into your children. Don't forget that. Last part, tech. Think about it. I encourage you to go to Pfizer and Moderna sites to learn how this is a grand, massive experiment. Again, what they openly admit it. You'll find this to be the largest science experiment in human history. Think about how lacking in contagion this virus was. In New York State, it had to be placed into communities where the most vulnerable are to begin a massive killing spree. Yeah, in New York State, Andrew Cuomo, Governor, we called him King Andy, ordered people infected with the virus to be sent to nursing homes with 15 body bags. They knew this, yet they won't charge him. Oh, why? That's because if you're a Democrat, you don't go to jail. Not in New York State. Not when you're governor and you are – this is stuff that I can't – it's crazy. And I've got to keep going. Some of these things just are insane. They're just so insane. I'm going to go on and I'm going to talk about something else that's insane, in keeping with combination of the things I've been talking about. Let's talk about a recent article, again, about this kind of combines all of this insanity. And I've been talking about my interview as well. And it's, again, part of this control that's happening, part of this control of like the vaccine, things like that. It's all with controlling the narrative. There are investigations in allegations that the vaccine may cause infertility. Have you heard that one? I want you to think about that. If you're controlling the narrative, would you want any young people being vaccinated? I mean, anybody under the age of 50, would you want them being vaccinated if it could cause infertility? So you could be 12 and your parents could be telling you, get the vaccine, and then you'd never have grandchildren from that. That young girl or boy would never be able to have children. That's one of the things they're actually talking about. Doctors are talking about. In WND.com, you can find an article by Bob Unra. The title is Doctor Warns. Listen clearly to this title. Too early to know if COVID shots cause infertility. Too early to know? You mean they never checked this? Before they sent it to the United States public and vaccinated millions of people, and now they're pushing it on children? A doctor, the chief of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, is warning that it's too early to know whether the COVID shots are causing infertility, but it's too early to know they're not. Oh, isn't that scary? The warning from Dr. Jane Orient, MD, follows a separate warning from a top-level legal team from just days earlier that universities should not mandate the vaccines for a number of reasons, including they could kill students. Orient has now explained, if your faith forbids sterilization or your respect for human rights forbids involuntary sterilization, then you need to consider the risk of infertility from COVID jabs. We do not know that the COVID jab will cause infertility, but we also do not and cannot know that it doesn't. There simply has not been enough time to see. Well, how many people do they have to experiment on? Times. How long are they going to wait to find out? How many are they actually following? Oh, keep thinking about this. There's another reason why they're asking this question, and I will get to that when I'm done with this article. She said that various institutions have begun demanding that thousands of young people choose between taking the jab or putting their educational plans and careers on hold. How much risk can we ethically take or coerce others to accept, whether the risk is infertility, miscarriage, disability, chronic disease, or death? It was the legal team of William J. Olson, PC, that earlier dispatched letters to the chiefs of colleges and universities across Virginia suggesting strongly that they withdraw their demands for students to take the experimental COVID vaccine. Before your students, before your students are harmed or killed, warns the letter, which was sent on behalf of the Center for Medical Freedom Health, Freedom Virginia, Virginia Coalition of Medical Freedom, CNU Parent COVID-19 Mandate Concerns, University Parents for Informed Consent, Students for Medical Freedom, Virginia Tech Freedom of Choice, JMU Freedom of Choice, Virginia Freedom Keepers, the Virginia Project, America's Future, and Students for America. There are many thousands of students who have been planning to attend Virginia colleges and universities this fall, but who refuse to yield to mandates that they first participate in unmonitored experimental genetic therapy by taking the COVID-19 vaccine. The letter explains your institution's policy of putting these students and their parents in an untenable situation where they must choose between accepting the significant risk of bodily injury, possibly lifelong disability, or death, or continue their education at your institution. Now, Orient has explained that the letter outlined the ethical and legal issues. I'll tell you more about those in a minute. The letter also requests a commitment to assume financial liability for death, disability, or illness of students being required to take COVID-19 inoculation. While manufacturers are immune from product liability, those who coerce students or employees to receive it might not be. She wrote, investigations that might inform us about the productive risks have not been done or reported. More than 700 posts injection miscarriages have been reported to the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. Where are the pathological examinations of the placentas? Were there spike proteins in the blood vessels and inflammations that cut off oxygen or nutrients to the baby? We don't know. An NEJM article that concluded there were no safety signals had no information on the placentas. However, Her to-the-point questions include, was there damage to the reproductive organs of nearly, listen to this, 7,000 persons who died post-injection? The first only autopsy report of an 86-year-old man published in June did not address this. The earlier warning signals she cited include, nanoparticles are meant to be distributed widely and do accumulate in ovaries, testes, and uteruses. What happens to the lipid nanoparticles? Pay close attention. We're talking about technology that has been injected into you. Nanoparticles that enclose the genetic material in the mRNA vaccine. You heard that. Nanoparticles. College students are probably delaying marriage and family until educational and career goals are achieved, so they might not discover infertility for years. Once injected, the genetically engineered materials cannot be removed. We don't know how long the mRNA or spike proteins it codes for will remain in the tissues. Risks and benefits need to be considered for different age groups. Persons past reproductive years have a higher risk of disease. Younger persons seldom get seriously ill with COVID. A one-size-fits-all mandate is without justification. Her warning was that shots involve not only an individual's spiritual, parental, and career advisors, but there is potential impact on all future generations. Think about, can you imagine that the massive amount, the thousands and thousands of people who are young that have been injected, if they could not have children after this? I'm not saying that's 100%. That's not what this article says. It's saying it's a risk that is being evaluated. That's the important thing to think about. Let me read this other part. It noted the links between vaccinations and myocarditis. The legal team's letter pointed out the federal government has refused to adopt draconian shot mandates, and the military also has declined to take that step. It noted that links between vaccination and myocarditis confirmed America's VAERS system, which documents complications and side effects of treatments, had gotten 326,239 event reports for a range of adverse events. Some 5,000 of those situations resulted in death. Further shots are unnecessary because of the availability of successful treatments. The letter said, citing ivermectin, which was found to obliterate 97% of the cases in a Delhi study. What's going on, people? How can anyone push this vaccine knowing that infertility is a risk? To push this on 17, 18, 19, and kids that are just touching their 20s. Their children. And you think they can make that decision on their own? Well, in states like New York, they're starting to pass laws that allow 12-year-olds to make medical decisions so they can have the vaccine. Well, when you hear those things, doesn't it start to sound like this COVID-19 thing is all about getting the vaccine? There's a new story here in New York State, came out of the New York Post, but it's about what happened in Michigan with COVID-19. This came from, again, it came from the New York Post on July 5th. Michigan boy dies in his sleep 3 days after getting vaccine. Oh, a 13-year-old Michigan boy died in his sleep 3 days after receiving the coronavirus vaccine in June, and the CDC has opened an investigation into the death. Jacob Klinik was preparing to enter high school in the fall, received a second dose of Pfizer on June 13th, his aunt told the Detroit Free Press. Jacob was healthy, had no underlying health conditions. In the 2 days following the second jab, the only side effect he had experienced were the same ones most others had to deal with, fatigue and fever. On June 15th, 2 nights after receiving the second dose, Jacob complained of stomach ache before going to sleep and never woke up. He passed away in the middle of the night at home, his aunt Tammy Burgess said. The CDC investigation was confirmed by the county health department. The medical The medical examiner performed an autopsy, although a cause of death has not been determined. The investigation as to whether there is a correlation between his death and vaccine is now at the federal level with the CDC. Is this a risk you're willing to take with your children? Why are they vaccinating children? They have almost no ability to catch the vaccine. They have several different things about them that allow a natural immunity. Yet, this is being allowed. I'm beyond disgusted. I do want to go back a little bit and talk about one more article on the topic of terrorism and jihad. This comes from the Washington Free Beacon, and I wish I could say it surprises me. Biden is not someone I would trust because the man has dementia. There's no question about it. I mean, the world leaders are laughing at the United States. Oh, you elected a man with dementia. Oh, yeah, sure. You have to have his wife has to serve in the role of a mommy to make sure he can do things and stay awake. You ever heard of something like that before in the United States? Every single man who served in that role didn't need someone to mommy him. But we have that today. Washington Free Beacon wrote an article titled Biden Admin Deletes References to Palestinian Terror Incitement from Congressional Report. State Department silent on removing references to malign Palestinian behavior in congressionally mandated report. What are they talking about? This comes from Adam Credo, one of my all-time favorite writers. If you ever get a chance, please go to the Washington Free Beacon, read Adam Credo's work. It is always outstanding. This came out July 6th. The State Department deleted references. Are you hearing the terms? Deleted references to Palestinian government's terror incitement in a report sent last week to Congress, highlighting what some see as an effort by the Biden administration to downplay Palestinian violence as it restarts U.S. taxpayer aid to the government. Well, what's their purpose? They've been trying to claim that the money will not be used for terrorism. It is against federal law for them to finance terrorism. But if you give money to the Palestinian government, you are financing terrorism because they do take the money and they do finance people who killed Jews. Yes, and if you get, I mean, they will pay them. They will pay those who, their families if they commit suicide. So how is that not supporting terrorism? So Joe Biden's team is downplaying that. They are doing stuff to break federal law to make themselves legal in financing illegal activities. Some of these things are just so horrible to hear about. My next article comes from Italy. And I try to keep up on things from around the world, and I just can't share enough. I would need a six-hour show, a 12-hour show. There's just no way to get it all out every week. I wish I could. This comes from ANSA. Now, I recommend people go to this site also, ansa.it, if you want to learn more about what's happening in Italy. It's a great news site. And you can get it in an English version, so this is definitely translated well. Four arrested for funding global terror jihad. Okay, think about that again. What is the crime here? It could be treason. It could be murder. Do we need the crime of terrorism? Just pay attention. This came out July 5th. Italian police on Monday arrested four people in Andria, north of Bari, on suspicion of funding terrorist jihadis around the world. Police said the four had about €1 million in over 1,000 money transfers to 42 foreign collectors in 49 countries between 2015 and 2020. The countries all have a terrorism risk, police said. They included Serbia, Turkey, Germany, United Arab Emirates, Albania, Russia, Hungary, Jordan, and Thailand. Most of the money went to the Islamic State and sister organizations in Syria. Money was sent to Russia a few days before a terror attack in Dagestan that mowed down five women praying in an Orthodox church on February 18th of 2018. The arrestees are all Andrian citizens, aged 29, 30, 32, and 42. The two main characters were identified for the money transfers, one between Turkey, Lebanon, and Mid East, and one through the Balkans. Think about that. Who do you think is involved? Or do you need to ask? Is that a question that even needs to be thought about? Some of these things are just so hard to accept that just because they're real. This next one comes from Nigeria, and we'll get into one of my last stories after this. Nigeria is suffering a huge amount of persecution of non-Muslims and Christians because Islamic hatred is just so overpowering. It pushes the concept of jihad. This comes from One News Now. ICC raises alarm over kidnapped Christian students. This came out today, people. This is by Charlie Butts. Concern is growing over the latest kidnapping victims in Nigeria. Christian students were taken away after the school was attacked. International Christian Concern, the international watchdog group, reports that Bethel Baptist High School was attacked in the early morning hours on July 5th, and 153 students were kidnapped, who grabbed the students and ran. ICC spokesman Nathan Johnson says no one has taken credit for the violence, and that means the kidnappers could be Fulani militants, a criminal gang, or Muslim fighters of Boko Haram. Regardless of who took the students, the fact that they are Christians makes their situation perilous, and the national government is not going to help. Yeah, because they have a Muslim leading. Think about it. They're not going to do enough as they would have if they were Muslim children, like we've seen twice before, Johnson advises. Or the third option is kind of a mixture of both. Kidnappers don't want to let Christians go, and the federal government doesn't care enough or doesn't want the children released. Yeah. Hard to accept, hard to believe that a government would not protect its own. But we've been seeing that in the UK. We've been seeing it all across Europe. This is just hard to accept. Let me get to this last article. I've got to get to the right page. I'm using a couple screens here. And it didn't pop up. Let's see if I can find it. I want to say there's a lot of places out there for you to find the truth and to fight for the truth. I want you to think about those things. What do you have to do to get the truth out today? If that means following people like me, the Sutliffian Report, going and getting the news yourself, that is more what's important. You doing your own research. You don't have to trust me. Check it. Please, please do check what I'm saying. Find out if what I'm telling you is true. Check me on it. If you want to give me a hard time saying I'm telling a lie, please contact me. You can do that through LinkedIn, Facebook. There's a wide variety of ways to contact me. My concern is that you get the truth out. You have to share it because it's not being shared in the major media networks. They don't want you to know a lot of what's happening. They want to protect the commies and the Muslims working together. We call this the red-green axis, where they work together as the enemy of my enemy is my friend type thing. It's happening. Look at CRT being pushed on your children. Look at the mandate of vaccines for no other reason. Red-green axis is becoming successful. My suggestion is twofold. Get yourself to a church. Find Christ. There's nothing better than finding Jesus. If you are looking to find the truth, that is that he is the truth. Now, I'm going to tell you a few other things that I want to warn you about. Coming down the road, I want you to think about the concept of what is this purpose of this vaccine. Some people claim it is and could be a forerunner of the mark of the beast. Now, I've recently been sent some stuff from people who believe that, and I can say I'm not sure. I do know what the Bible says about the mark of the beast is will be on the forehead or in the back of the hand. And if you actually follow things on biotech and understanding when they're talking about taking pictures of people and, you know, how that works out with computers and that kind of technology, they're actually doing incredible studies of your forehead for this. Now, think about that. If we're talking about this mark having been on your forehead, because of COVID-19, they have now been able to ability to identify persons by camera using technology at a rate they've never been able to do. Before, they would be able to say, well, we can't see the whole face. We can't identify. Now they can. They only need your forehead. Think about that. And again, the scriptures talk about the forehead as where a mark will be that it could identify you as a follower of the beast, or on your hand, back your hand. What is the purpose of these vaccines? Could that be? We've just seen so much progression. I honestly don't know. I don't believe in what I consider. I don't like the concept of conspiracy theories. I really don't. I like to talk about things I have facts behind. But now I'm starting to wonder, where is this going? What is the purpose behind these forceful vaccinations? Because if they're into sterilizing our children, if that's part of the purpose, and we won't know this, they're saying we won't know this for years, maybe decades. Population suddenly drops. Think about it. It's a totally scary, scary concept. I have been reading tons and tons of material on the vaccines, the purpose for the vaccines, and I'm seeing this push for communism in our public schools and socialism in our public schools. Beyond anything that makes any sense, because legally, there's laws that have been put in place where any kind of group that supports these kind of governments of communism are not legally allowed to even be brought into high schools. There's federal laws, yet they're doing it. This is the stuff that's scary. The people in office see nothing wrong with violating laws. They are creating laws for you and not laws for them. You can see this by people like John Kerry getting on a plane or going through an airport and not wearing a mask. But, you know, the laws are for you, not for them. These are scary things. Will they actually take a vaccine if they know that the laws are for you, not for them? I hate this concept. I'm really disgusted with the whole thing. And this is the stuff I'm seeing. I'm documenting. Just like I did with the book that I recently put out. Stop. You guys need to stop and start watching. I just want to say thank you for listening, and I'm going to say goodbye, and I'm going to sign off with the streaming. God bless you all for paying attention. Thank you. Thank you for listening, and I'm going to say goodbye to the stream. This stuff is scary. Some of the things are shocking. And I have to say goodbye to the stream first because I cannot play the music, which I love to play. Toby Keith, I have to say, is a great patriot from the stuff I have seen. And, oh, hi, boy. Sorry I did not say hello earlier. Thank you for joining. Bring it, boy. Thank you for being here. I don't know what to tell people beyond get informed. Stop being wimpy. Stand up, men. Stand up and be men. What am I telling you? You got to stop letting people tell you something. Find out for yourself. Do your own research. Be a grown man. Don't be the wimp. Don't be a follower. You have to do your own research. Stop trusting others. Don't trust me. Find out for yourself if what's true, if what I'm saying is true. That's your job, not mine. Here we go.
American girls and American guys will always stand up and salute. We'll always recognize when we see your glory flying. There's a lot of men dead, so we can sleep in peace at night when we lay down our heads. My daddy served in the army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard till the day that he died. He wanted my mother, my brother, my sister and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free. Now this nation that I love is falling under attack. A mighty sucker punch came flying in from somewhere in the back. Soon as we could see clearly through our big black eye, man, we lit up your world like the 4th of July. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And the eagle will fly, and it's gonna be here. When you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell, and it'll feel like the whole of the red, white, and blue. Justice will be served and the battle will rage. This big dog will fight when you rattle his cage. You'll be sorry that you mess with the U.S. of A.